Hello, y'all. This is Scott Merrick from the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, welcoming you to episode number 33 of Snacks for the Brain. I was lucky enough the other day to spend a little time with my new friend, Dr. Randy Reiser, who's a postdoctorate fellow at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center. His main area of interest is evolutionary biology. Give a listen as we talk about his research, check out the resources at the blog site, and more or less, just listen up.
We'll keep it G-rated for sure.
First, tell me how to pronounce your name.
Reiser.
Reiser.
Yeah, it's
like an extra syllable in there, right?
It does have a little bit of an extra syllable. It's an old German name they like to throw around those ERs.
Yeah.
But it means the traveler, and I wish I could get to the point where my name actually describes my activities.
Perhaps once you retire. See, my problem is I sort of retired in my 20s. Went back to school and got my education degree and started teaching. And this is my 10th year at USN, and I keep telling people that I've already retired, and now I'm going to work till I drop. So,
well, I did something similar. I stayed out of school for 5 years when, just after high school.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of burned out. And by the time I was in my early 20s, I decided, well, you know, I don't want to be dumb forever, so I went back to school, went to college, and I knew at that point I wanted to be a biologist, and I thought initially that I would study birds, but I got to the University of Kansas, and I started talking to ornithologists, and they told me how difficult it was to get your hands on birds. You know, I really wanted to be able to handle the animals, do some hands-on biology. And so that's when I made a switch over to studying amphibians and reptiles. And
of course, you can get your hands on those guys, eh?
Find them very easily, and I just go around turning rocks, and there they are.
Well, I have to say, I've looked at some of your web work, and if there are students listening to this or teachers listening to this, use the podcast links at the blog site to link to Randy's site. There's some very interesting videos there.
I study some behavior called caudal luring. It's one of my
That's caudal, C-A-U-D-A-L.
Yeah, it means tail luring. And it's an interesting phenomenon. I study luring in vertebrates in general.
Mm-hmm.
And what luring is the use of an appendage to attract prey into strike range. And this happens in fishes, frogs, turtles, and snakes, and even lots of invertebrates.
Mm-hmm.
But I've focused mainly on snakes and to some extent fishes as well. And recently I've been collaborating with some folks from Arizona and a professor from Cornell on an evolutionary theory that this luring behavior drives the evolution of feeding on extremely large animals. Think about this. The anglerfishes can eat enormous prey, more than their own body mass.
So, wow.
Snakes can do this. Many snakes can do the same things. And there's this funny word that we use called, it's megaphagy. And it literally means eating something very, very large.
Sort of like a, I don't know, Fat Moe's burger or something.
Right. Well, if you can just imagine sitting here atop the table that we're that we have our elbows on, a 300-pound hot dog. Just imagine that.
Okay.
It's a pretty big hot dog.
Got it.
Well, here I am. I weigh about 210 pounds. I'm going to open up my mouth and put it in my stomach. Well, at this very moment, I have gained more than 150% of my, or approximately 150% of my own body mass. Now, how do I deal with this? How do I deal with this meal physiologically, behaviorally? It's outrageous, right?
Right.
Well, a lot of fishes do this on a regular basis, and some snakes do this on a regular basis. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. Why in the world would you want to do this? Well, it turns out that some organisms live in environments that are very low energy flow. So they their prey come along very rarely. So when they do come along, these organisms need to be able to use what's available. So they not only do they eat smaller prey, but they have evolved to eat much larger prey too.
Whoa.
So that they can keep a continuous energy balance toward the positive end.
So I would imagine they get very lethargic after we've chowed down this 300-pound hot dog.
Well, I don't know too many people who haven't seen a boa or python mm-hmm. feed. And, of course, these things, you can see cartoons about pythons and boas eating very large things. And yes, they get extremely lethargic. They sit around and digest that prey item for a very long time.
How interesting. So your main interest is in evolutionary biology?
Yes.
And so pretty much everything you do is connected to that?
Well, I wouldn't say everything I do. I study behavioral neuroscience as well as evolutionary biology. My heart is definitely in the evolutionary biology. At the moment, I have a lot of projects going that involve evolution and behavior of organisms. And my research in general deals with behavior. My research here at Vanderbilt is supported by the National Institute of Health, and that deals with the behavior of mice.
Thank you, National Institute of Health.
Good old NIH.
You have participated in one of the interactive video conferences from this very room, I believe. We're sitting over in Light Hall on the 8th floor in the Center for Science Outreach office. Tell me from your perspective as a presenter, what's that experience like?
It's an interesting medium because you don't, when you first go in, you don't realize that there's going to be a delay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very different from being there and talking to children one-on-one. And of course, I've done a lot of educational work with children out at the schools or on a nature trail or on the zoo grounds. I find education extremely rewarding. I appreciate the evaluations and I'm looking forward to doing more of the teleconferencing. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, we've only recently reacquired the ability to archive these presentations. So you had question and answers after that presentation, right?
Yeah. They ask a lot of really brilliant questions, and I find this to be the norm, that children, they listen well,
mm-hmm.
and they understand, and then they process it and put it all together and just ask fantastic questions. Gives me great hope.
It also gives you a chance to get in any given... I'm hoping you will do some more next year.
Oh, yeah.
This also gives you a chance to reach a number of kids in a number of locations at one time, which I think is useful. If there are any scientists, research scientists or otherwise out there who'd like to participate, check out the website at www.vanderbilt.edu/CSO. There's a place to sign up right there on the website. We'd love to talk with you or email anybody on the staff.
Next, we got to talking about a wonderful, fantastic, incredible new find featured in the April 2006 issue of Nature magazine. You just have to go out and find it and read it to believe it.
So the new species that was discovered in Arctic Canada?
This is Tiktaalik, and this is an incredibly cool fossil. Speaking of the human lineage, we can just take that back to 380 million years when the human lineage looked a lot like the fish lineage. Tiktaalik is in the news, and it is big news. It's a 375 million year old fossil. That's the Devonian period, found on Ellesmere Island, Canada, and it's above the Arctic Circle, so this is classic Arctic environment
mm-hmm.
with glaciers and polar bears and so on and so forth. During a couple of months of the year, the snow melts, and between the glaciers, there's this nice Devonian rock that can be explored for fossils. And a group of scientists, led by Neil Shubin and Ted Daschler, and another professor, Ferris Jenkins from Harvard, they've been going up on, I think, a yearly basis looking for fossils, and they have just come by an amazing find. Tiktaalik is a transitional form between some other fishes that we have as fossils. Acanthostega is an amphibian, and it's a transitional form between fish fossils like Pandorichthys and tetrapod fossils like Acanthostega. So it tells us a lot about our own evolution, especially the evolution of our elbows and wrists.
Which is a pretty amazing transition from fin.
Yes, it's a Tiktaalik has a fin that is essentially formed around a lobe, and this lobe is the primitive arm. And within the lobe, Tiktaalik evolved from lobe-thin fishes like Pandorichthys. And within this lobe, we see the elbow, the beginnings of the elbow and the wrist, and these bony elements inside of this fin appear to be flexible so that this fish could move its fin in ways that other fish could not, earlier fish.
So this would be a feature that eventually evolved into the human arm, mm-hmm. and as it began being, I can move my fin. Maybe not intelligently, but by an impetus of need or whatever.
Yeah, the whole idea here is that this fish didn't know it was going to evolve into anything
at
all. But evolution works by tinkering. It's not a directed process in any way. It tinkers with what's available. The earlier fish, they had lobe fins that worked well in their environments, and Tiktaalik had fins that worked well in its environment. And its environment, from the evidence of the rocks that it's found in, was a river delta environment with small rivulets. So probably what this fish was doing is staying mostly in shallow water, potentially hauling itself out onto a dry land upon a rare occasion. Now, later on, we see things like Acanthostega that could come fully out of the water. And like I said, Tiktaalik is a real nice transition between things that were permanently in the water and things that were able to haul themselves out on land for long periods of time.
Once they were able to haul themselves out on land, there was no stopping them.
That's right.
Wow. We've been talking about Tiktaalik that's featured in two related research articles highlighted on the cover of the April 6, 2006 issue of Nature magazine.
Wow.
Okay, here comes the question you've been waiting for.
Let me ask you a political question here. As you talk with people about evolution, there's quite an uproar all over the country about the teaching of evolution and debate about intelligent design and all of those things. I'm sure that you could probably lay out some sort of professional stance. What's your personal feeling about all that?
Well, it's a thick issue. I believe that we definitely need to have tolerance for everyone's beliefs. A lot of times people grow up believing something, and it's very difficult to let it go. And a lot of times, there's not enough information in the whole world to make what mom and dad believed incorrect. So that's why the issue gets a little bit thorny. And I grew up in rural Kansas, and I understand the backgrounds of these types of people very well. On the other hand, I think that there are a lot of evolutionary scientists and scientists in general who try to hammer the message home without thinking about how other folks might respond to their message. So whenever I encounter someone who isn't quite there in terms of their beliefs, I try to separate one thing from another. And I try to help them understand that believing in evolution doesn't necessarily mean that you don't believe in the things that your parents talked about and told you, and the belief system that you grew up in. So you can separate the two fairly easily, and I think there's really no reason to beat people over the head with a scientific stick.
You're here.
And it's important that we that we educate people. Now, some more of the thorns that come out of this bush is that policy is often it follows religious standards, and when policy is dictated by religion, then we have a serious conflict. And so a lot of policy, recent policy about education, has come under the blanket of the far religious right. And I think that we have to be very careful to do exactly what I said. Try to separate the two and try to be sensitive about beliefs versus science. And the debate about intelligent design is a debate that spans beliefs to science. Intelligent design is a belief, simply put. Evolution is a scientific theory. And a lot of people say, well, it's just a theory. Well, how is that any better than a belief? Just a theory, just a theory, just a theory. But a theory in science is actually something that's far more powerful than a fact. And a lot of people don't realize this. A theory is a body of evidence that's supported by many, many, many facts. And evolution is such a theory. It has stood the test of time, and it is a theory supported by thousands and thousands and thousands of facts. So far, we haven't been able to find any facts that do not support the theory of evolution. So that's a strong indication that the theory of evolution, of biological evolution, is a correct theory.
Thank you for sharing today, Dr. Reiser. And anything more you'd like to say about Tiktaalik? That's got to be a Yupik word, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Probably sounds more like
Tiktaalik. Well, it was. I think it's awfully nice of these folks to name this animal after the indigenous peoples.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you go to their website, they have their website both in English and in the native language.
Very enlightened.
Very.
That's highly unusual. A sensitive approach to going in and digging around in their property.
Indeed.
In their native lands.
Right. And more these sorts of things are being done. In Africa, those human fossils are often left in Ethiopia. The groups of scientists that come from the United, or that go from the United States and dig up these fossils, they end up leaving them and taking casts back to their institutions to study, because these are national treasures and it's part of their heritage. Ethiopians can be very proud. They live on the soil that produced the human lineage.
Amazing.
That's it for today's Snacks for the Brain. Check us out next week. Thanks for listening.
Music for today's podcast is provided by Pod Show Pod Safe Music Network.
See ya!